Okay. There we go. All right, excellent. Well, the past few weeks we've had these incredibly, I don't even know how to describe them, parables that have just opened up things to us that we never thought were there or were weird or strange or far away, and we just still find them difficult, and today is absolutely no exception. This story of Lazarus is just weird, and it doesn't line up with a lot of things that we think. So all I have to say is here we go again, ready to dive into the scriptures like we have been. So I want to, however, start with just a brief review. What, as do you recall, is the primary purpose of the parable? To build faith, yeah. So I hesitated, Larry, because to teach, you know, you get faith out of that, yeah. But it's to build faith, and Jesus is using this particular method to build faith. And we remember we've compared that over the past few weeks by saying a lot of us were raised in a manner where the parables were read in such a way that we would think this is how you figure out right and wrong. What's evil and what's good. And that can be very helpful. And, you know, figure out what's good as often as you can. That's a good way to go. However, the primary purpose when you read a parable or hear it is to build your faith. And you come away from the parable with a larger picture of God, something you did not have before from the realm of the kingdom of God. And that's what building faith is about. Now, here's a bonus question that is a little deeper than review. How does this building of faith usually happen when you read the parables? Yeah, I know. I know. I was nervous about the space, the silent spot on the MP3. Right. So. You want me to tell you, don't you? Okay, all right. I will. Usually the building of faith by reading, encountering, and engaging with the parables is through a larger image of God than what you've had before. And that's what happens. When you engage with the parable, you're encountered with an image of God that is beyond what you may have carried into it, and that will increase your faith, which will in turn increase your ministry. All ministry comes from Jesus. The more you see of Jesus, the more ministry you'll have capacity to do. Now, I'm so glad you're looking at me like thinking, oh, that's a wonderful idea. However, it goes counter to what most of the things we do in most church settings, and that is where we think this is what we want to do, we come up with a plan to do it, and then we start going about doing it, and then we remember to ask God to bless it. And it doesn't produce what we think it will produce. The way to grow ministry and the way to grow churches is to first see more of Jesus. And then the capacity for ministry increases. And the ability to touch more people increases. And it all comes from Jesus. Which, of course, we've been sharing fairly consistently throughout. All of it is always about Jesus all the time, no matter what the question is. Always Jesus. So there we are. And that's what we do with the parables specifically, is we come away with more of him. Absolutely. Yes, that's right. Yeah, if you were raised in Sunday school, that was always the answer for your teacher's question. Excellent. All right. Now this parable also has this point, even though it is very difficult to see. It can be very difficult to see. And you remember that there are two reasons why the parables are hard to understand. One is they tend to be culturally different from our culture right now. The American culture we're in is very different from the culture of Israel in the first century. And so there's things that are happening in these stories that you know, we begin to see them, and it sheds light on what's going on. But there's also the main thing underneath that is our image of God that we carry into the parable is smaller than the image of God that is portrayed in the parable. And that means it can be difficult to understand also sometimes. So we go ahead and we ask God, show me your face, as Moses did. And God will do that. He will put you up in the cleft of a rock and say, be careful because I'm going to show you my face. And there you are. And that's what's going to happen. So that's what we're going to do today. That's what's happening. Now this... Yes, absolutely. Right. So Sonny's question, an excellent question. Did Jesus think up these parables on his own, or were some of these stories around in the culture, and did he adopt them? Yes, that's what he did. They were around in the culture, and then he would pick them up. That means that people who were listening to them could understand what he was saying, but then he would add in or change in a little bit or a lot what God was like, and it blew them away. That's why he got into trouble. Yeah. Actually, whoever understood it, right. His hearers would have understood more immediately than us because the cultural barrier wasn't there. So immediately, the image of God and of him being God was carried directly into their ears and into their hearts, right on the spot. We get to go a little slower, which gives to our benefit sometimes. So what we see in this particular story is a deep, full picture of God, and we could spend over a year just on that, out of this story. But we won't. It has a powerful underlying message also on how we relate to God. And that's really the convicting part for us, the part where we're challenged and grow. It's not only seeing more of God than we've seen, but how do we relate to God then after seeing that? And here is, I think, the crux of this parable and the challenge for us. A God that we can manage will never come through for us like Lazarus. A God we can lean on and trust with everything we have will set all things right, like he did for Lazarus. So the rich man is trying to manage things, his life, his God, and that God's never, never going to come through. Lazarus, no matter what his situation, was leaning on God with everything he had, and he saw things set right. That's very challenging, very challenging. And when we see how following a God who leads us instead of one that we can manage and control, he will define our relationship with him, and he will open up ministry to the community. No, that was incorrect. He'll open up ministry with the community. So that's what we're going to see here. Now, just a couple of items to help bring out some more of what's going on in this parable. The rich man did not seek God at all in his life. And in the first sentence describing the rich man, we can see that. We catch that he's a son of Abraham, meaning he's Jewish, at least ethnically. But he has a huge banquet every day. What does that mean? No Sabbath day. He did not observe a Sabbath. And he expected his household to not observe a Sabbath, but to work every single day. He's just not practicing the faith in which he was born, and perhaps even circumcised and raised in. He's no longer doing that. And he thought that he should be served all the time, even in hell. Even in hell. He's calling Abraham and says, now would you please, would you do this? Oh, okay, well then would you do this? He never stopped that expectation. So that's where we see the rich man. The dogs. There's just one line about the dogs. The dogs were probably guard dogs for the rich man who would start barking if somebody wanted to break in and steal his stuff or whatever. And they're kind of given a negative interpretation. Even when you read it, the English translation says, even the dogs came and licked his sores. Well, the dogs were the only friends Lazarus seemed to have had. They're there showing him some affection, probably keeping him warm at night, got to know him pretty well, were not attacking him, and all that. Now, that's just an aside because we're going to have the blessing of the animals next week and all this. And then Lazarus, here he is in this awful situation, and he never once shows the desire for revenge or punishment of anyone at any time. He just kept looking for God when he was able to, when he was physically able to pay attention. That's what he was doing. And he wasn't wishing the worst for the rich man or anybody else that was around him. Just kept looking for God. Leaning on God is what he's doing. And so he saw more of God as a result. Okay. Now here's what I want to do. As I've been hinting at, there's a lot in this story. And we could spend months and months on it. But I want to bring out one aspect this morning. And that is mission. There's a missionary aspect to this story that ties into the image of God that we carry. Okay, here we go. The mission for the rich man is on his doorstep. This man had the means and the opportunity to help Lazarus eat. Somebody's on the phone. Oh, it's Larry. All right. Okay, there we go. Yeah. Okay. The rich man had the means and the opportunity to help Lazarus eat, to help Lazarus get healthy, and to help Lazarus get employed. Everything was right there within a very small area for that mission to be accomplished and that community to be transformed and Lazarus to live a very different life. Everything was right there for that rich man to see God at work in someone who was sick and poor and hungry and dying. And he could have joined in with that with what he had. But he didn't do it because his image of God didn't allow for that. He felt God was someone he could manage and keep at arm's length at least. And if he ever got into trouble, I don't know what it would have been, but if he ever did, then maybe he could have called on God. Managing God that way. Keeping God over there. I know he's there, but he's over there. When you are looking for a manageable deity, you will not see or be able to join in with the mission or purpose for which you were created. When you catch the direction of God, you catch the provision of God to fulfill the mission and purpose for which you were created. In other words, you keep God at arm's length, and it will be extremely difficult at best to know the purpose for which you were born. When you lean on God with all of your heart and everything you have, the provision to fulfill the purpose for which you were born is right there. And it'll be flowing. Everybody okay? See, because what I just suggested was that you no longer come to God on your terms, but you ask God, God, what are the terms you have? That's where I'll be. That's very challenging. That's very challenging. And I just want to reassure you a little bit. You don't figure that out in seminary. When the bishop and the other clergy come up and gather around you and lay hands on you, you don't figure it out then either. In fact, you never figure it out. You're always leaning on him. Not trusting your own ways, but all your understanding, all you have is on him. And that opens the door. So how do you catch it? That's how you get it. You catch it. Like a cold. Except you want to get real close to people so they catch it from you. Now, how do you catch it? Well, last week we looked at the passion audit. I don't know if it was around here in the room yet today, but we looked at five different ways that you can perhaps begin to see what it is that God wants you to do, the calling on your life, or however that is. I want to describe that all a different way this morning, because it all hinges on the image of God that you have, and then putting all your trust on that. And that's what opens it up. And I want to describe it this way. We're building a life, each of us individually and together, we're building a life that can go with the Spirit of God. And the Spirit of God is like the wind. And the wind will blow wherever it will, as Jesus said. Our life, our spiritual disciplines, our discipleship, our faithfulness in attendance, coming in to worship, doing things together, power washing the walls, whatever some of us did yesterday, all of that, spiritual disciplines, which build a sail. And a good part of your life becomes like a sail. And that sail catches the wind and takes you where the Spirit of God is going to take you. Your boat is the vessel that carries that vision, takes you to where you're going. I mean, you can't stand on a sail, it'll sink. But to put the sail on the boat, which is the vehicle that takes you to where God is leading you. And that vehicle is the fellowship that you have with others, the kinds of things that you do with other people to carry out your faith, whatever it may be, whoever Jesus has added to you. Now, this is what I want to ask you to imagine. And in the boat, in your boat, there's a net. And that net is something that you occasionally drop over the side. And it brings in those that Jesus has put on your heart and on your mind. I want to give you a very interesting thought about a net. Because you remember that when Jesus first called Peter and James and John, they were fishing. They've been out fishing all night, caught nothing. And Jesus comes along and they've got the net out on the beach and they're tending to the net. And when you tend to the net, you let it dry out in the sun, then you pull the debris out of it, then you tie up the places where it's ripped, and then after it's all dried out and cleaned out, you fold it up in a certain way in the boat. That whole process of tending the net is described in one Greek word, katartismo. You can impress your friends with that if you want. Jot it down. That same word appears in Ephesians chapter 4. And he called some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, some to be pastors and teachers to equip, or katartismo, the saints, for the work of ministry. The purpose, the process of being equipped for the work of ministry is so that those that God has placed on your heart are caught up into his net of mercy through you and brought close to him. That mission opportunity becomes visible as you see the image of God that he's revealing to you even this morning, which would be larger than the vision of God you had when you walked into the room. You go with those that God has brought together with you to the place where God is already working to the ones that he's preparing. That's the kind of life that you lead, and it could happen in millions and millions of different ways, but that's the process of the life you lead when you start praying, worshiping, giving, and seeking after God. Now, I'm going to ask you to imagine something in just a moment, but I want to make sure at this point, if you have a question, now's a good time to raise it. Okay. All right. Let's go right to the imagining, which is another way of building faith. I want to ask you to get whatever picture God is giving you of that boat with the sail, and the sail is your disciplines, whatever they may be. If your sail has a few holes in it, ask him what disciplines he wants you to add. But there you are. Picture that boat. Who is in the boat with you? It's your team. The ones who share the same desire, the same burden, the same fire going on within them. Here's the second question. When you drop the net over the side, who is it that you want to draw in? Who do you want to draw? Who do you want to draw in with that net? And for every group of five people, there will be seven types. Because the mercy of our God is so big. The mercy of our God is so big. Oh, if there's for every five of you, there'll be at least seven different groups. Okay. It's like that old joke, for every three or four Episcopalians, there's a fifth. Never mind. It's just a good thing we're not in a Baptist church this morning, that's all. Okay. Now this is what I want to do. I want to spend one more moment with you about this issue, this concern, this engagement with God. Just in front of Him. And let Him speak a little more into your heart and into your soul. And then I want you to carry that up to the table this morning when you come for communion. And I want you to tell Jesus, those people that you put on my heart and my mind, the team and the ones I want you put on my mind to draw in, I want them here at the table with me in whatever way you can arrange it. And for that to happen, here I am. Use me.